financial regulators. There is no comprehensive national law governing data collection in the United States, though many European countries have adopted similar measures regarding user privacy and corporate transparency.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for News from the Boo. At 6, it's The Underground, then at 7, Hard Knock Radio with Davey D. Tonight's weather is a 60% chance of showers, possible thunderstorms, and a low of 56 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be a 70% chance of showers, possible afternoon thunderstorms, and a high of 66 degrees. Today in history, in 1971, the U.S. Justice Department issued a warrant for the arrest of Daniel Ellsberg, accusing him of leaking the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times. The quote of the day is from another whistleblower, Chelsea Manning, whose profession Brainy Quotes lists as criminal. "I believe that when the public lacks even the most fundamental access to what its governments and militaries are doing in their names, then they cease to be involved in the act of citizenship."
Robert Mueller has agreed to testify after being subpoenaed by the House Judiciary and House Intelligence Committees. He will speak out about his investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election and possible obstruction of justice by Trump. Since publishing his findings, Mueller has only spoken publicly about the investigation once. In the briefing, he stressed that the probe did not exonerate the president and that Russia's efforts to interfere in the election deserves, quote, "the attention of every American." Hours after Mueller agreed to testify, Donald Trump tweeted, quote, "President harassment," and then once again called the investigation a witch hunt. Mueller is set to testify before the committee on July 17th in two separate open hearings.
A purpose of political debates is so viewers can make side-by-side comparisons of candidates, but what about when there's so many candidates you have to divide them over 2 days? The Democratic Party's random selection process ended up with four of the top five candidates, Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, and Pete Buttigieg, on Thursday, and just one of the top five candidates, Elizabeth Warren, tonight. Warren will be up against Cory Booker, Bill de Blasio, Tulsi Gabbard, Washington State Governor Jay Inslee, and Beto O'Rourke. The next debates will be in Detroit on July 30th and 31st with a different mix of candidates on the two nights.
There's another big upset in Queens, New York, as 31-year-old queer public defender Tiffany Caban defeated the establishment-backed candidate in the Democratic primary to be the borough's next district attorney. Caban campaigned on a platform of lowering incarceration, ending cash bail, decriminalizing sex work, and cracking down on predatory lenders. She had endorsements from many progressives, including Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and fellow Queens phenomenon Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Caban said, "Transforming this system will not be easy, and it will not happen overnight, but I am ready. We are ready." T.S. Kandil, a 26-year-old transgender sex worker, said it will be, quote, "amazing to have a DA who won't prosecute us just for wearing a little skirt and a pair of heels."
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Descendants of the Wounded Knee Massacre were in Washington, D.C. Tuesday to discuss efforts to rescind 20 medals awarded to soldiers for the massacre. They joined three U.S. lawmakers, including Deb Haaland, one of two Native American women in Congress, to introduce the Remove the Stain Act. The bill rescinds the Medals of Honor for the Wounded Knee Massacre, where hundreds of men, women, and children were slaughtered by U.S. soldiers in 1890. Lakota tribes and the National Congress of American Indians have requested the U.S. rescind the medals. During Tuesday's event, descendants honored Holland for her work with an eagle feather and gave her the Lakota name Takini Wicha Ki Zini, meaning defender of the Wounded Knee people. Representatives Denny Heck and Paul Cook co-sponsored the bill. Tribal leaders praised U.S. lawmakers in the House Tuesday for approving an amendment to secure a one-year moratorium on oil and gas drilling near Chaco Culture National Historical Park in New Mexico. The initiative by House Assistant Speaker Ben Ray Lujan was included in the Interior, Environment, and Related Agencies appropriation package, which passed Tuesday. Tribal leaders from New Mexico Pueblos and the Navajo Nation have been working with U.S. lawmakers on protecting the area from development, which tribes hold sacred. Leaders of the Navajo Nation in a statement thanked Lujan for his support. Indian country is still waiting for a U.S. Supreme Court decision in the case Carpenter v. Murphy. The High Court did not issue an opinion on the case Wednesday morning. Tribal leaders and legal scholars are among those closely watching the case, questioning reservation land in Oklahoma. Many in Indian country are waiting for an outcome of the case before the term ends this summer. Tribal leaders from across the country are gathered in Nevada for the National Congress of American Indians mid-year event. They're meeting with a number of local, state, and federal leaders to discuss top priorities for Indian country. Rhonda Lovaldo reports.
During Tuesday morning's General Assembly, John Tasuda, Indian Affairs Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary, touched on a number of issues the agency is working on. His speech included public safety and missing and murdered indigenous women and girls. He says federal officials recently met with tribes in Arizona to discuss such cases. Tasuda says the federal government is seeking to do more research into cold cases.
Some of these are not properly reported or did not get investigated before. We're now combining resources with the FBI and local law enforcement to make a greater effort to go back. If it's too late to bring the perpetrator to justice now, our hope is that we can at least bring some closure to families as well.
In the afternoon, NCAI attendees discussed various topics during breakout sessions. One looked at expanding technology and how to bridge the digital divide on tribal lands. Catherine Brigham explains why she attended.
One third of our reservation does not have broadband and our cell phone service. And so we've kind of established a kind of decided our staff need to explore ways to expand cell service and broadband on our reservation.
On Wednesday, NCAI will host a data and research forum. Topics include the United States Census, diabetes in Indian Country, and genetic research. The conference continues through Thursday in Sparks, Nevada. This is Rhonda Lovaldo for National Native News.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The first round of Democratic presidential debates is set for this evening. But while candidates take the stage in Miami to argue about what to do about climate change, Florida is burning, literally. But according to the DNC, Jay Inslee's request to have a climate crisis-focused debate is unnecessary. In the Everglades, a sawgrass fire has consumed 32,000 acres and continues to grow. Less than 100 miles away lies Miami, one of the cities most vulnerable to the effects of climate change in the U.S. In Miami Beach, flooding during storms and extreme high tide has become a severe concern. This, coupled with the 9-inch rise in sea levels, is a recipe for impending disaster. But the problem doesn't stop there. The land that Miami Beach sits on is made up of remnants from the prehistoric coral reefs, causing it to be extremely porous. These days, heavy rain or a storm doesn't even need to be in the forecast for the area to flood, as water bubbles up from underground. Additional problems the coastal state is facing include warming waters, exacerbating toxic red tides, waste disposal, contaminated drinking water, and storms unlike anything we've ever seen.
The Philadelphia oil refinery that exploded and caught on fire last week is said to be permanently shut down after the building sustained substantial damage. Philadelphia Energy Solutions is the largest and oldest refinery on the East Coast and typically processed 335,000 barrels of crude oil a day. This isn't the first time the refinery has caused problems. In 2009, Sunoco, the plant's previous owner, was cited for a hydrofluoric acid leak, a hazardous substance that can spread for miles as a gas. The explosion came as no surprise to those who live nearby, who have worried about environmental and long-term health effects of residents for years. Located in South Philadelphia, the neighborhood the refinery is located in is predominantly made up of working-class African Americans. A group of demonstrators from a local environmental group called Philly Thrive came out in response to the fire, protesting for increased transparency from the company surrounding ongoing health and safety concerns as a result of the fire. Prior to the explosion, Philadelphia Energy Solutions was the largest single air polluter in the city. Philadelphia is the 12th most polluted city in the United States.
Donald Trump has taken to Twitter to criticize his opponents yet again. This time, the president is railing against the American soccer player Megan Rapinoe. Rapinoe has helped the U.S. women's national team win both the World Cup and the Olympics. In an interview this morning, Rapinoe said she would not go to the White House if the United States won the Women's World Cup. In the three-tweet blast, Trump said that he would host the team whether they win or lose and told Rapinoe to, quote, be proud of the flag you wear, and warned the co-captain to never disrespect her country. Rapinoe is an outspoken critic of the president, along with being a fierce advocate for LGBTQ rights, along with racial and gender equality. In 2016, she became the first white professional athlete to join Colin Kaepernick in kneeling for the national anthem at sporting events in protest against racism and police violence in the U.S. Shortly after, U.S. soccer passed a rule requiring players to stand for the anthem. Several other players on the U.S. Women's World Cup team have announced they will not attend the White House visit. If the team refuses to visit the White House, they will be following in the footsteps of the Cleveland Cavaliers, Golden State Warriors, and Philadelphia Eagles, who all refused to meet Trump after winning their respective championships.
Thousands of protesters in Hong Kong marched to major foreign consulates today, demanding the world's leaders gathered for the annual G20 summit address their concerns and help liberate the city. Millions have protested in recent weeks against an extradition bill that would have forced individuals, including foreigners, to be extradited to courts in mainland China controlled by the country's Communist Party. Opponents of the bill fear that the new law could be used to send suspects to China to face vague political charges, unfair trials, and even torture. Protesters saw the new plan as another step to chip away Hong Kong's freedoms and legal autonomy. Chief Executive Carrie Lam announced a week ago that the bill would be suspended. However, tensions continue to mount due to protesters' desire to see Lam resign and the bill scrapped completely. Activists have condemned the excessive disproportionate force used by police at protests and are calling for an investigation into the brutality. Several countries have come out in support of the Hong Kong protesters.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael is worried about the climate.
The Oregon climate bill wasn't great, but it was something, and we need to do everything we can soon as we can. I despise those slacker Republican state senators whose egos are bigger than the planet. The climate crisis is coming for all of us, whether in Oregon, Idaho, or D.C., and Brian Boquist, no guns are going to stop it. While Betsy Johnson and Arnie Roblin, the two Democratic senators who openly oppose the bill, are the only two Democratic senators who got money from the Koch brothers, as well as big bucks from the timber industry. The rich are lazy, afraid to change, hate to be challenged. They won't share. At the coast, I saw all the homes that are occupied maybe 30 days a year, while some patches of downtown and inner east side sidewalks are slept on every night. My new curse is, son of a rich. Money is how God shows his favor, some say, while others say poverty and cruelty prove there is no God. The whole planet was paradise, and oil the apple I wish we'd been told to not eat. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 26, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Leslie McClam, Dan Raphael, Alex Connor, and Kenzie Beard. The producer is Lisa Loving, and our engineer is Tammy Hubtaeus. The interim director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Erin J. Bernard.
And I'm Leslie McClam. The Opal Environmental Advocates, the Youth Environmental Justice Alliance, and Bus Riders Unite have launched a campaign to push back against what they describe as an over-policed and underfunded public transit in the Portland metro area. This week's KBOO's Barbara Bernstein spoke about the new campaign with Orlando Lopez Bautista and Tristan Isaac, community organizers with Opal Environmental Justice Oregon and Bus Riders Unite.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM Seattle. And today we're talking with Orlando Lopez Bautista and Tristan Isaac, who are with their community organizers with Opal Environmental Justice Oregon and the Bus Riders Unite. And they're talking about their Up With Riders campaign. Just getting back to what you were just saying, Tristan, I actually remember when TriMet, when they were breaking the ground for it, which was, I think, 1982. And it was a great festivity, and the then Senator Mark Hatfield was there for the ribbon cutting. And it was seen as this really positive thing. And this is out in Gresham, because they broke the ground in Gresham and then worked their way back into Portland. And my memory of the light rail in particular being associated with crime was something that came much later. It came maybe 10, 15 years after the line had been running. And it just seemed to accelerate. And it's true that there have been crimes on, particularly, I think more on the MAX line than on buses. And I also know that when I lived in New York, you know, the subways were not the safest place and people had their purses snatched. And I also know that the metro in Paris is famous for pickpockets. So this is something endemic, I think, in mass transit and on the streets all over the world. But I wonder, for one thing, I wonder if you feel like the perception of the crime on the MAX line in particular is really overblown, and what generates that illusion or delusion?
I feel like, you know, wherever cops go, they're going to find crime. So if you put more cops in a particular area, the perceived amount of crime goes up because everybody commits crime everywhere all the time. You know, it's just a matter of who gets caught doing it, right? If you put a bunch of cops in, like, Laurelhurst neighborhood, you probably catch as many criminals as you do in, like, Brentwood, Darlington, right? But, you know, it's really just, like, the stigma around public transit and people wanting to see cops on there, and TriMet funding the transit police division so that, you know, this is, like, one central division that just patrols the transit system. Naturally, the, like, perceived amount of crime is going to rise. You know,
and I do want to touch on something, because, like, I think it's something that a lot of people, like, might not get across when we first talk to them about our transportation system, especially when we talk about, like, a decriminalized system. We're not saying that we don't want a presence on transit. That's not what we're saying. So, because we've already gotten some folks telling us, like, oh, you want to get rid of police officers? Like, well, we don't believe police officers, is how we would define safety for us on transit. We actually want to go towards a different type of program that would provide safety and security on transit. So from the, like, 1994 up to 2009, there was a program called the Rider Advocate Program. People who were trained in de-escalation, who provided other resources for folks, who provided help and assistance for folks who were trying to use our system. This is a system that we want to move towards, something that, and this was a small program. We want to expand it so that it can reach as many as lines as possible. It's we can't put one on every bus or every MAX because that's just, it's not financially feasible. But to like, we can have a significant group of, you know, folks who are dedicated to being on transit and providing these services at a much like lower cost than having transit police officers.
Well, one of my problems with the Portland mass transit system forever has been that there's not enough of it, and it doesn't go to all the right places, and the routes are kind of screwy, and this is kind of compared to living in a couple cities that that had really good mass transit. My understanding, though, is even the cities that used to have good mass transit, it's all kind of falling apart in the last number of years. But it seems that TriMet has some problems with understanding what would drive more ridership. And I wonder if you see some of those conflicts or contradictions between what they see to drive ridership and what would actually help. And or do they really care about how much ridership they have?
I think they do. You know, the more riders they get, the more federal funds they have access to. But they're also very stuck in like a very like profit-driven mindset where they just feel like transit has to be this like service that people pay for. And so if they see ridership declining, they'll raise fares to like make up the difference, and then that just drives more riders away. And they like to invest in these like costly light rail projects, which, I mean, light rail is fine, there's nothing wrong with it per se, but if you put it in and it starts underperforming, you can't take it out, you know, you're stuck with it for a while. And they're building up a lot of debt related to this when just adding more bus lines would be cheaper and more effective at getting more people to ride the system.
You know, there was a vision, and I keep going back to the 80s when I think there was a much more visionary leadership at TriMet. But when they were first putting the first MAX line in that ran from downtown out to Gresham, it was going to be in conjunction with all these crosstown bus lines. So there was going to be a bus line like from Grand and MLK and on 11th and 12th and 21st and 39th and all the way out to 82nd. We should have probably gone out to 122nd. And it seemed really great. The other thing that they did at that time was, you know, this was earlier, I think in the 70s, they cut the fare. Instead of raising the fare all the time, they actually cut the fare, and it was like 45 cents to ride. You could go from Estacada to Hillsborough for 45 cents. And that seemed like just very amazing. I was also going back to New York a lot in those times, and the cost of the subway and the buses in New York was so much more than Portland. I really appreciated what Portland was doing. So there seemed to be a vision of you lower fares, you make them accessible, and you put on more lines. And also the idea that not every bus line should go through downtown to get anywhere, but you could actually have crosstown. But then there was a budget shortfall, so most of the crosstown bus lines didn't happen. Those are all the 70 number buses that didn't even exist when I first came to Portland. And so they cut the bus lines, and they still had the MAX line, and it was definitely better, but it wasn't this great vision. Then a number of years ago, I don't know, 10 or 12 years ago, they had another budget shortfall. So then they cut the buses some more. And in like my neighborhood, which I don't have the greatest bus service, but the main bus that I use used to come every 10 minutes. Well, now it comes every 15 or 20 minutes and a half hour on the off hours. And I discovered it was taking me twice as long to get home from downtown as I had before. That seems to me to drive away ridership when you cut service.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
But I mean, I just wonder, do you ever talk to anybody at TriMet and find out why they think the way they do?
We go to their board meetings, and, you know, we have one-on-one meetings with some of their staff people. And I think there's just, like, this culture that's just, like, persisted over the years. And even sort of new people who, like, come on board, and we feel like they might be, like, more visionary and radical, or just kind of, like, very quickly fall into lockstep with everybody else. But yeah, like I honestly can't really say for certain why they feel the way they do.
Well, I'm wondering.
I think a part of it's also like there's things that they would like to do, but they're unable to do because they don't have the jurisdiction to do it, right? And I think for a long time, like there's been this element of like cooperation between, or like non-cooperation between like the city of Portland Metro and themselves that's prevented them from like doing something bigger and more bold and more visionary. It's not until recently that like they're like, you know what, like let's actually put a transportation bond out there that would address this And even prior to that, TriMet was actually trying to do this by themselves, right? They're like, we're going to lead this transportation bond that's going to pay for the Southwest Corridor. But in order for us to get it, we've got to make sure that we have to fund the I-5, I-205, and other major highway things, because that's what's really polling well. And they knew if they were to just put the Southwest Corridor on the ballot, that it would fail. But one of the things that we challenged them was like, you know, like, hold on. We will not support this if the only thing, the only transportation, like public transit system, improvement that you're going for is a Southwest Corridor. What we want to see is actually a robust system, like a service improvement, a robust like public transportation system, sidewalks, bike lanes, and all these other multimodal options be part of this like transportation bond. So what we're seeing now is that like Metro is kind of like finally doing their job, convening these other like stakeholders, the city of Portland, TriMet, Beaverton, Gresham, all these players are coming into the table. There's also the business community, and a number of nonprofit organizations. It's funny that we were not invited, considering that we have a long track record of advocating for public transit and among other things, but that's a story for another day. So what we're asking for through this transportation bond is like, we really want to make sure that dedicated bus lanes and other bus system priorities are put onto this ballot measure, or that are funded through this ballot measure. And part of the reason is because, as you mentioned, like, you know, like people are noticing that it's taking a lot longer for them to get to their destination. Like we just started conducting some surveys around congestion and its impacts on transit riders. And what we're seeing is that a lot of people are saying like, you know what, like it's taking me up to like an additional 30 minutes to an hour already on top of like the normal ride at like when there's no traffic. Like it's taking me an additional 30 minutes to an hour to get to my destination. Like that's a long time that you're spending every day of the year trying to get back home or trying to get to your destination because traffic is getting people stuck, you know, on transit. Like, so if we were to have a dedicated bus lane in some of these busy corridors, buses would then be able to reach their stops on time. People would see it as an adequate alternative to driving. And then we wouldn't have to be subsidizing more parking in the city. We wouldn't have to be subsidizing like more like highway construction, so like expanding freeways, because that's just a waste of money. Like this thing that people think that like, oh, why don't we just expand this because that's what we've always done. That's not sustainable. I mean, our cars are becoming more fuel efficient, so the gas tax money that used to be coming in is not meeting that demand. In addition to that, like it's becoming more costly to like rebuild our streets and roads. So like, if you add more cars onto our streets, like we're not going to meet our climate change, like climate goals. Like we're not going to, like we're allowing more emissions to go into our neighborhoods. And the people who are impacted the most are like low-income folks of color who don't have the resources to address what's going on in our neighborhoods.
Well, I want to talk about this neighborhood that gets a lot of short shrift, and that's the I-5 corridor through North and Northeast Portland. Mm-hmm. And I thought that the expansion for I-5 was kind of, I hadn't heard about it for a couple of years, but it seems like it's on the table again. And I know that I get stuck in traffic whenever I'm on the freeway over by the Coliseum and whatever that area is. No more Coliseum, but that mm-hmm. area around the Moda Center. And
or the Rose Garden, for Rose
some. Whatever it is, right? That, and actually, when I'm there, I'm trying to imagine what it would be like if they added extra lanes. Is it just going to cut into the neighborhood? I mean, it's certainly not going to be at all very. It'd be very invasive for the neighborhood. But the other part that's just common wisdom is you build more lanes in a freeway, you just attract more traffic.
Absolutely.
And I've lived long enough to have witnessed that. I remember when I-205 was like my own personal freeway when I lived out in Clackamas County. And that was back in the 70s. And now it's like a parking lot, particularly around rush hour.
Yeah. And so you look at in Los Angeles, like they've built so many freeways and they're still in gridlock traffic. Like you look at Atlanta, you look at Dallas, you look at a number of cities, and it's something that it's very hard for us to like tell folks, you know, like this is what's happening across the country. People are trying to build their way out of traffic and it's not working. and it's a lot of wasted money that's going into this, right? We have to change our way, the way we get around town. Like, that's like, we cannot continue this unsustainable way of like trying to move or invest in our transportation system. Like, this could literally bankrupt our state in the future.
And not to mention the air.
Community radio station. This month, we'll screen They Will Have to Kill Us First on Thursday, June 27th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. Islamic jihadists took control of northern Mali in 2012 and enforced one of the harshest interpretations of Sharia law in history. They banned all forms of music. They Will Have to Kill Us First tells the story of how musicians are fighting against the ban, standing up for their cultural heritage and identity. The film includes footage of the first public concert in Timbuktu since the music ban. Again, that's They Will Have to Kill Us First on Thursday, June 27th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Coley Neighborhood Farmers Market. This is a weekly event at 5011 Northeast 42nd Avenue at Alberta Street in Portland. The market features local farmers and businesses, and this Thursday, June 27th, there will also be a seasonal cooking demonstration and music by Loose Change. Again, that's the Coley Neighborhood's Farmers Market, Thursday, June 27th from 4 to 8 p.m., at 5011 Northeast 42nd Avenue at Alberta Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Portland State University, offering a master's degree in urban and regional planning for those who want to shape